Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Diplomatic History Channel here at New Books Network. We've been on a bit of a hiatus for the last several months, but we are back with our latest episode here. My name is Grant Golub, and I'm one of your diplomatic history hosts here at New Books Network. And I am delighted to welcome back to the show Christopher McKnight Nichols to talk about his new edited collection with David Milne, who is unfortunately not able to join us for our conversation. Ideology in U.S. Foreign Relations, New Histories. And Chris is the professor of history and the Wayne Woodrow Hayes Chair in National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at The Ohio State University. He just started in this position in the summer of 2022. Chris specializes in the history of the United States and its relationship to the rest of the world, particularly in the areas of isolationism, internationalism, and globalization, as well as the roles of ideas and ideologies in U.S. Foreign relations, which we're going to be talking a lot about today on the podcast. He's the author of or editor of six books, including the one that we'll be discussing, but also Rethinking American Grand Strategy, which he co-edited with Andrew Preston and Elizabeth Borgwardi. And we talked with him a little over a year ago about that volume with him and Andrew. And you guys can listen to that anytime here on New Books Network. And he's also the author of probably his most well-known work, Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. So, Chris, great to have you. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Grant. Thanks for having me here. Thanks for the kind introduction. And I'm really looking forward to talking about the role of ideologies and ideas in U.S. foreign relations, which clearly connects to the question of grand strategy.
Yeah, definitely. So let's just jump right in. And I'd like to talk about what the motivation for putting together this volume was, and what sort of your vision along with David's for this book was when you guys started putting together all of these fantastic chapters.
Well, yeah, it's a good place to start. Sort of the genesis of the volume, I think, was the kind of thing that many folks listening will resonate with. Reading Michael Hunt's very famous book, Ideology and U.S. Foreign Policy, years ago in graduate school, got me thinking about the subject, even though I was at the time very interested in the role of ideas and ideologies in the U.S.'s role in the world, but got me thinking about the subject and what was missing from that book. It's a fantastic work, probably a lot of listeners know it, but it very much smacks of a kind of late Cold War moment. It's very much about justifying why we should think about ideology, and especially at the kind of elite policymaker level. And so my thinking there, as it slowly evolved over time, as I've studied ideas and ideologies in foreign relations, and fantastic scholars like David Milne, my co-editor, who wrote, you know, has written books on Walt Rostow and world making and the kind of world views and disciplinary perspectives that shape how policymakers and citizens alike, but he's mostly focused on policymakers, shape how they view the world and the kinds of questions that they address and the ideologies they deploy in trying to come up with foreign policy strategies. In conversations with those sorts of folks, I realized that, you know, we really needed a kind of new synthetic work that brought together the foremost, many of the foremost people thinking about ideology and foreign relations, but also broadened the base of who and what counts there. And this is something that's informed a lot of my work and other subjects as well. So, you know, we're looking at grassroots actors. There's a fantastic chapter, we can get into this a little bit more later, on, you know, children and generational questions. You know, so there's a lot more to cover when you think about ideology and the kind of world views of individuals and groups that are impacted in or implicated in foreign relations. And so the Hunt book was a stepping off point, but so much was the kind of cutting edge new directions in the field of the US and the world, where people have been looking a lot more at ideas and ideologies and don't need to quite justify a focus on ideas and ideologies in the way that they did in the era of Hunt, or frankly, in the way that they do in other fields like political science, where there's more of a concern of, you know, tracking that quantitatively, what's the one-to-one relationship between, say, democracy promotion and policy outcomes. You know, historians care a little bit less about that direct causal relationship, and we're more interested in kind of the context. And that's really the more important thing, or the language, the rhetoric, right?
Right. You know, something that really, I think, struck me about what you were just talking about with the Hunt book, which was written, you know, at the very, you know, at the, in the last years of the Cold War, I think it was published in 1987, in which you were sort of talking about, you historians of that period had to sort of justify talking about ideology more, is that when you listen to a lot of political discourse, I think, you know, over the last, you know, couple of decades, let's say, or even less, especially I think amongst, you know, certain quarters of the discourse, there's sort of a skepticism towards the idea of ideology as being a motivating factor, not only in U.S. foreign policy, but just in American politics in general. And sort of, it's sort of seen as, I think, by some as a smokescreen for other things that animate why people pursue certain policy objectives. And it usually relates to, at least in this sort of reading, economic forces, people's, you know, personal financial standing. You know, it's more of a cynical take, I think, on ideology as not being sort of a legitimate underpinning of why people do what they do politically or believe what they believe politically. And so I wanted to ask you about how you and David and a lot of your co-authors sort of contended with sort of these more recent ideas about the role in ideology, not only in American politics, but more specifically in American foreign policy, since that's what the volume is focusing on.
Yeah. So I think first, I think your observation is exactly right. That's something we've maybe heard more of in recent years, or heard at a higher kind of register or decibel level. I'm not sure when you track the history, how different that is over time. I think, you know, when you look at policymakers and citizens alike, they've often eschewed a kind of ideological mantle, or have suggested that the real values underlying a policy that they hope to achieve, or that a position they hope the U.S. will have in the world, are shaped by other kinds of principles or assumptions or contexts. In other words, if you look to some moments in the 19th century, questions about morality or, you know, Christian values might have been what would have been championed in the political rhetoric, alongside a kind of denial of any other ideology, say, you know, avaricious empire, for instance, or something like that. But, you know, these are the tools of the historian, that, in fact, when we look to the historical record, when we look to political rhetoric, when we triangulate across letters and documents and debates, we can actually find, you know, that there are foreign policy ideas embedded in that public rhetoric, and that they're sometimes, you know, just as salient as anything else going on there. So, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting about this volume, we decided to bring together, you know, senior scholars, very well-known names, and some junior people, kind of rising star folks, was that we disagreed in some ways about, you know, what constituted ideology precisely, or when, where, or how ideology made a big difference or didn't make a difference. But one of the fundamental precepts here was that there is such a thing as ideology or ideologies, and that ideologies are important in the understanding, historical understanding and analysis of foreign policy over time. And I think we can get to the more present context for sure. But you know, as you go back, one of the things that the volume tries to do is start before the revolution and to think about, you know, how long it's been in U.S. history that various kinds of ideologies have been evolving and developing to shape how Americans and how others perceive U.S. foreign relations, and that there are some through lines there that we can discern as historians that might help us understand, you know, where we are in the world today, in fact, but certainly understand different kinds of pivotal moments in different ways by saying, okay, it doesn't matter that policymakers or citizens want to reject a kind of ideological orientation. Can we find in the historical record ideas and ideologies at work?
Right. And, I mean, talking about one of those through lines, I think that's a good segue into looking at your specific chapter in the book, which focuses on unilateralism, which I think is an ideology or an underpinning of American foreign policy that goes, you know, that you can see all through American history. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to sort of unpack your chapter, thinking about unilateralism as a ideological underpinning of U.S. foreign policy. How did you sort of approach this, especially when this is a topic, I think, from a lot of angles that has been written about quite a bit, but you have such a fresh take on it. I was curious to know, you know, how you were sort of thinking about this as you saw it over sort of the long durée of American foreign relations.
Yeah. So first, you know, there are a few historians and political scientists who have written about unilateralism, but there's been less sustained analysis than I would suspect. I was a little surprised to find that there haven't been many folks who've done much on unilateralism over time through U.S. history. And I think you're exactly right to emphasize, you know, the kind of enduring positioning of unilateralism. One of the things that I say, you know, in the chapter is that it may be the longest standing kind of default foreign policy ideology that the U.S. has. And it's one that the U.S. comes back to in very different contexts. Policymakers and citizens try to update. You know, one of the jumping off point for the chapter was my observation, which will probably resonate with listeners, and also connects with where you opened, which was the kind of transactional unilateralist orientation of the Trump administration. And that a lot of the commentary on this as a supposed abrupt break from, you know, say, the World War II kind of consensus liberal international order of the U.S. being part of multinational and multilateral coalitions, collective security like NATO, and we could go on and on and make a long list, that this was some abrupt break and it was a shock and it was a deviation and people couldn't understand it, right? And so one of the things I sort of note there is that unilateralism has often been brought up as a kind of to tar different foreign policies, but also as something that's heralded. And that when you go, you know, much farther back and you think about some of the benefits for policymakers in different moments about a unilateral impulse or for citizens, it's a really clarifying one because it asks the most basic question of all, which is, you know, what are the vital interests of the U.S. and is this particular policy designed to advance them? Now, of course, there are myriad answers to that question that's almost always, you know, vigorously, hotly debated, but it gets you to a much more precise and easy kind of logical position than, say, clearly more complicated questions about multilateralism and collective security or multinational trade deals, right? The sort of things that both the Trump administration, but also, say, the Thomas Jefferson administration would have been wary of, right? That this could pull the U.S. into kinds of configurations of nations and groups against the U.S.'s best interests. It could factor in ways foreseen and unforeseen in, you know, harming domestic interests, right? So just to put it diplomatically and broadly, right? Now, we could we could, you know, shoot down some of those kinds of claims pretty rapidly. But as a way of configuring that policy, that seemed pretty important to me. You know, the other thing I think, well, what I try to do with the chapters, it's a sort of a think piece on unilateralism. Like, let's think together about what it meant, what the definition might be. Yeah, I think it's fascinating, and it was news to me when I was doing this research, that multilateralism was coined first as a term, and unilateralism came later. That seems okay. Very salient.
Yeah, that's very interesting, right? Yeah.
The kind of things that I've studied related to isolationism, of course, factor in here. And I've been thinking about unilateralism as one of the key components of an isolationist framework for thinking through and revising the U.S.'s quote unquote proper role to the world. We often do a disservice by thinking that multilateralism today is the default. And I think it might be more useful to think that U.S. foreign relations sort of values often are grounded in unilateralism. And then you need to build up policymakers and citizens alike to a place where multilateral configurations make more sense. Now, that may sound more like IR or something along those lines or theory, but when you look to some of the historical moments where the US has made these kinds of moves, where the US was really pursuing, you know, something along the lines of going it alone, you find in those particular moments, you know, political debates that center on something that seems a lot like ideology. And that's the other question here, that there is something more to it than just an impulse, right? This visceral thing. This is why I started with the Trump administration. It's some visceral attitude towards going it alone, that's just plain good. Whereas, in fact, lots of very smart folks, you know, in lots of different historical moments and political debates have argued for a kind of unilateral orientation, in the sort of ism sense, in a deeper political philosophical sense, that really did try to think through many dimensions of what it might mean to go it alone. Say in bilateral treaties and reciprocal kinds of deals, ad hoc alliances rather than more enduring ones. You know, it can be a lot more complicated than just some gut rejection of the world. In fact, many of the unilateral sorts of orientations of the U.S. have been towards individual peoples and groups. And, you know, I'll just broaden out one more second, if you'll permit.
Of course, of course.
Is that, you know, unilateralism isn't pacifist necessarily in the historical record of the present. And, you know, you can think about whether or not a unilateralist orientation would support, say, arming Ukraine in the present, or why it did or didn't, say, support revolutions in Hungary and Greece in the 1840s and 1850s, you know, and other kinds of historical moments. So what did this deeper philosophical kind of position mean towards U.S. intervention, aid, humanitarian relief, and actual war making? And that's a piece of this. And you might then ask some really interesting questions about, you know, how unilateralism as a political philosophy or as an ideology can morph and change in different political circumstances. And that's kind of what the historian in me is suggesting. Hey, as you think about this concept and set of ideas, when does it become ideology? When does it just function in some other form? And does that matter?
A lot of things just struck me about your overview of your chapter, but two things I wanted to sort of dissect a little bit more was this, you know, idea. You know, I think that if you were to listen, if someone were to wake up, you know, in the United States today and listen to people talking about foreign policy, you know, you would think that the United States, in a lot of cases, has always sort of been a country that's really invested in multilateralism, invested in, you know, what a lot of folks refer to as the rules-based liberal international order, setting aside whether that's something that actually exists or not. But, you know, sort of that this post-World War II U.S. orientation on American foreign relations has really always what's animated U.S. foreign policy. In other words, it's kind of been the default. But, you know, I think as you were sort of pointing out, right, it's really not, you know, like it's really the opposite. And that's so interesting to me. I was curious to know, like, unpacking that a little bit, why, you know, like why there has been this shift away from, you know, sort of unilateralism being this sort of core ideology underpinning American foreign policy, right? Because unilateralism was seen as being the you know, smart and prudent way to approach the world, right? I mean, it was, you know, one of the things that underpinned, you know, George Washington's farewell address, right? You know, avoiding foreign entanglements and sort of this idea of going it alone. But you see this big shift during World War II. I mean, and now it's sort of, you would think that this has always been the bedrock. I mean, what's really animating that exactly in your view?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it might be worth rehearsing quickly some of those the data there, just so people are pretty aware, right? So you're thinking about Washington's farewell address, you know, but even before that, model treaty with the world in the Revolutionary era, you know, there's a host of things that happen in the early 19th century, from, you know, arguably the Louisiana Territory purchase, right, in 1803. You could walk through the Napoleonic Wars. You can even think about U.S. expansion in Asia, trade and naval routes, and all that sort of stuff in the 1830s and 1840s. You know, this was more about, you know, in China and Japan in the 1850s, more about, you know, the push forward for the U.S. as a single nation, not with other allies or groups, but pursuing its own interests, sort of unfettered. You know, think even about the war with Mexico, expansion in that way, making sure that U.S. borders more or less were secure, even if that, you know, kind of avaricious war to nab territory from a weakened Mexico was not exactly anything to glorify. It was clearly a unilateralist orientation to expansion and to create security. You know, and then it, you see a kind of updating of these ideas in the late 19th century. And the question then, say in 1898, the war with Spain, is about, you know, what does it look like to be a modern empire? You know, to, there's a the phrase, you know, the U.S. is a good enough England, which comes a little bit before that. And even so, that's about a kind of unilateral orientation to these new territories coming under American power. And there's a lot of open questions there. And imperialists and anti-imperialists don't know how to deal with these questions of racism and racial hierarchy, which play a big role in this book on ideology. They don't know how to think about citizenship or immigration, also plays big roles in this book on ideology. But you're exactly right to point to this World War II moment, right? So if World War I, the U.S. entered as an associate power, not as a formal ally, which I think is really important. I emphasize it all the time, and I think people don't really know what that means, but it means the U.S. troops weren't fighting under foreign flags, and the U.S. was not really functionally a full ally. And if you think about the peace that's concluded, the rejection of the Treaty of Versailles, you know, not joining the League, also not pulling out U.S. troops until 1923, you know, concluding a separate peace, all of this is of a piece with this longer-standing kind of unilateral orientation. Again, doesn't mean the U.S. doesn't enter into wars. It doesn't mean the U.S. doesn't make catastrophic errors in terms of conflicts, or, you know, really advantageous self-aggrandizing moves of gaining territory, right? You know, these can all be held there together. But the World War II moment is this change in thinking about multilateralism. And I think a key component of it is historicist, that it's learning the lessons of World War I. It's an argument about learning the lessons of World War I. As we both know, you know, thinking about my co-editor Elizabeth Borgart's book, A New Deal for the World, Stephen Wertheim's recent work, there's a number of books that talk about, you know, the post-war planning happening in the midst of the war or even before the war for World War II. And I think so much of that was premised by liberal internationalists on an orientation to being a more genuine multilateral power, even if it meant relinquishing some authority. Right. And of course, we can quibble with how much of that there is. The UN is in New York. Most of Bretton Woods happens in the US, et cetera. Right. The dollar. We could go on and on about the institutions that are constructed. So there's a lot of hegemonic power in US multilateralism. And I think, to my mind, that joke aside, that's the key to it. You might even argue that US led multilateralism is very much unilateral. Now, we'd have to really be very specific to see when, where, and how that balance is best noted. But what I'm saying in the chapter is that, hey, look at the debates that come after that moment, right, of World War II. So often the U.S. comes back around, U.S. political debates, and particularly citizens who reject particular forms of multilateral action, they come back to this bedrock set of ideas about unilateralism and say, hold on, let's have this debate about the nation's best interests, about thinking through whether or not multilateralism is the antithesis of unilateralism. And if that is the case, then is that a good thing? So, or to put it another way, in this historical trajectory, and I mostly focused a lot of the piece, even though I focus my own work largely on the post-Civil War era, early in the 18th and 19th century, to put it more simply, I cite Walter McDougall somewhere in there, and he says something, forgive my paraphrase, you know, the history of the 19th century is the history of the U.S. thinking that unilateralism works. And then I would argue that that bedrock then becomes foundational for all the rest of the foreign policy apparatus that is built up and premised on multilateralism, but it's still there, you might say, at the that foundational level as a place to come back to check assumptions and core ideas. And that's where it fits with ideology, which is really about, you know, making a complex world more finite, organizing your concrete ideas, your assumptions, your sense of deep principles, and then deploying them towards some ends, like making the complex more clear. And in that clarifying prism, you know, things like unilateralism can be quite helpful in ways that multilateralism sometimes seem too complex. And this is where you get to the level of political rhetoric. How do you convince people that a certain cause for action is useful? And that's why I began with this question of, you know, was the unilateralism of the Trump administration so different? And you know, my argument there is that no, it's not so different, frankly. But the rhetoric they use was both more persuasive to certain subsets of the U.S. and far more alarming to others who were saying, hey, you know, we're actually a multilateral country and we believe in these kinds of principles.
Is there something about the development of American society, American politics, American culture that has, you know, pushed, you know, important segments of the United States to be really enthralled with this idea of unilateralism as a core ideology in the creation of American foreign policy? You know, is there some sort of connection here with American exceptionalism or Americans' ideas about the creation of the American Republic? Or are Americans really not all that different from people in other countries who, you know, are crafting their own foreign policies?
Well, I'm always of the mind to say Americans aren't that different from other countries and to be a comparativist there. But I think I would say that American unilateralism historically has been grounded in a kind of exceptionalism. And one of the things that we find in a lot of the ideologies in U.S. foreign relations in the book is that exceptionalism is taken as a kind of core assumption, sometimes very much uninterrogated. And so I think that that's certainly true for unilateralism. And I think, you know, in recent years, if that's part of your question, you know, this if we attempt to historicize the unilateral shift of the Trump administration, you know, I think one of the things we see is that these America first kind of nationalist unilateralist positions fit with a whole long set of policies that go pretty far back. And so that shift isn't new. Or the current move taps into things that are much more longstanding. I would add, and I don't know how much I say this in the chapter, to be honest, I think that cosmopolitanism and pluralism changed the mix of how unilateralism was deployed in the U.S. And so I would date that in some ways to the rise of pluralist ideas that Horace Kalin, Randolph Bourne in the progressive era, that as lots more immigrants come into the country and the kind of melting pot ideal was debated and cultural values are being heralded as better off distinct than melted into some homogenized whole, a kind of unilateralism that coalesced around nativism becomes a much more potent stream in American political thought and rhetoric. It was there before, but I think it wasn't as under threat. The unilateralism of the 19th century, to be very broad and generalized, was often one of a weak nation trying to deal with security concerns and grow. And by the 20th century, you're beginning to see a much stronger commercial, cultural, and military power then debate whether or not what the mix of people within it should look like and what that meant for the future of the nation. And so some groups were more embattled. It's a pretty obvious observation, but I think it's actually perhaps also profound in that it helps explain elements of America First, not just in 2016, but in 1940 and 41 in some ways. And arguably the America First of groups like in the Klan in the 60s in the civil rights movement.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's sort of going off from thinking about the idea of American first, which, you know, it's over like the course of the Trump presidency, it was always sort of fascinating to me, like how scholars, you know, historians, political scientists, you know, were coming back, political theorists were coming and say, you know, America first is not right, like something that Trump invented, even though one might think that he had, right? There's this really long, problematic, complicated history of this idea, you know, thinking about like the America First Committee during World War II, you know, those who were opposed to U.S. involvement in the overseas conflict, or, you know, the America First ideologies of the Klan. You know, like you watch the movie Black Klansman and you see the Klansmen, like, you know, toasting America First, which was supposed to be like this really, you know, jarring moment because that movie comes out right in the middle of the Trump administration. But sort of thinking about, which I think you were sort of starting to get to in some sense, think, and you talk about this in the chapter, the relationship between the idea of unilateralism and the one of isolationism, which is a term that has been talked about, you know, has entered the discourse a lot again, you know, in large part because of the Trump administration's foreign policy. You know, how do you, because I saw other scholars have talked about this relationship, but I think that you sort of unpack it in a way that is somewhat different from the way that other scholars have taught about it, because, you know, it's the idea, right, of like eschewing, you know, foreign commitments, but mainly, you know, for example, the way that Robert Taft thinks about it, but that's because it would entangle us in other people's conflicts or other people's issues in a way that he felt that the United States shouldn't be getting involved in them.
Yeah, very much. I mean, I think there, one of the things I really wanted to do in the chapter was to connect multilateralism, unilateralism, and isolationism. And I do that, and I think a little bit with the reader, I hope, kind of asking questions sort of the isolationist strains of thought, which I've written a few essays on, and the relationship between unilateralism and isolationism. You know, one of the things that, so I put out the phrase that I take from Taft, but you see it in other places too, the doctrine of the free hand. And we often, you know, if you're just quickly hearing that, you probably think, oh, laissez-faire economics. But actually, the free hand was about autonomy and sovereignty, and that the U.S. In the post World War II era should be prizing its sovereignty and autonomy more. So for someone like Taft, the lessons of World War I and World War II are that the U.S. probably shouldn't be sucked into power politics in the world system, and should probably pursue its own course. So for instance, he's arguing, and almost wins the Republican nomination in 1952. He's arguing for, you know, much smaller U.S. military footprint, you know, next to no Marshall Plan. Don't ramp up, you know, aid to Europe in anywhere near the shape or size that we know of, and we now think of it as almost universally positive in the sense that it helped grow the world system and economies and standards of living and all that kind of thing. His argument was the U.S. would do a lot better if it devoted those resources at home. You know, and that's a very persuasive kind of take, and it fits quite neatly with the sort of isolationist positioning, you know, as I've diagnosed it, which is to say, yeah, sure. You know, it's, although the phrase isolationism has usually been opposed, you know, frequently been used by opponents, right? It's a slur and it's an epithet. If you unpack the ideas, you know, it's about the attitudes and policies of people who want to pursue a kind of continued adherence in other eras to what they conceive of or assume to have been key elements of a successful foreign policy in the earlier era. And in particular, what that entailed was things like avoiding political and military commitments or alliances with foreign powers, especially Europe, right? So it had a hemispheric carve out, which I think is really important to understand U.S. foreign relations and this kind of thinking. And that it had this kind of unilateralist bent as one of the key components there. So you have a kind of several main positions within the isolationist sort of intellectual constellation. I often think of this best as understood as sort of in a constellation of ideas. There's these main points. And in most of the main points of isolationism, kind of global diplomatic commitments should be unilateral. Maybe not in every case, and there's some room for ad hocery, but going it alone makes the most sense, is a core set of commitments in this sort of ideological sphere. And, you know, again, this is, again, a very basic point, but it shouldn't surprise us that that comes roaring back periodically. And you can point to moments of this, right? The end of the Cold War is another moment. There's a great new book out by Nicole Hemmer, Partisans, about Pat Buchanan. You know, one of his huge appeals is about this sort of, is a kind of, let's go it alone now. You know, instead of a unipolar world, it's just the U.S. And let's stop with the polls, right? And let's limit who comes into the U.S. And it's, you know, it's a white nationalist position. It's, xenophobic in many ways. But it shouldn't surprise us that it's very appealing. You know, I think it's when there's big crises, the Eisenhower's version of multilateral U.S.-led global engagement was pretty popular, but the Korean War was very unpopular, and people like Taft, did a good job of opposing it, saying this is the kind of thing that's going to get us into a lot more trouble. Why are we doing this?
Right. Yeah, that was a really good point that bringing up Nicole Hemmer's new book, Partisans. You know, she just had a piece in the New York Times sort of talking about some of the themes of the book. And it was striking, like, how many similarities there were between someone like him, Buchanan and the movement around him, and then thinking about Donald Trump and also, Ross Perot, who was running in 1992, right, as a third party candidate, also talked a lot about these things too, about, saying, let's get rid of, the unipolar world, let's get rid of the polls. It's just the United States. Let's focus again on the United States. We don't need to be dealing with other countries. We need to limit the amount. And, he got like 18% of the vote in, the popular vote in 1992. Like, it was a really, really popular position. I think a lot of people, sort of laugh at this kind of thing, right? But it was really attractive to a lot of people.
Yeah, and way more so, I think it's, you laugh at your peril, right? Because these are obviously very attractive ideas that lots of people find merit in, and that can lead to positive as well as negative outcomes, right? More balancing within the U.S. Can lead to things that lots of us want. One of the examples that I've often given when I've given talks on isolationism and unilateralism is to say, that we know that this is a false quid pro quo, but it's there. The burn rate per month in the Iraq war in the first 4 years was roughly the same as universal health care in the U.S. Now, it's not like the U.S. Congress was going to pass universal health care in the early 2000s. But, if you think about how much these conflicts abroad cost the U.S. or multilateral kinds of commitments might cost the U.S., there's a clear appeal to some of these domestic things that actually cut across the political spectrum. It shouldn't surprise us that this is a really potent set of ideas. And the other thing, this is speculation on my part, but a couple of the chapters in the book touch on this. These moments of rupture and crisis over historical time really help to illuminate the ideologies at work that are under contest, that are under pressure, right, that are debated. So like 1992 is a good moment to see that. So the Cold War seemingly over, you've got a recession, you're coming out of the Gulf War, is this a new world order situation? The George H.W. Bush kind of orientation of a sort of multilateralism meets a sort of unilateralism, right? The unipolar moment. Or should something else take precedence there? You could look to 40-41 if we're just doing kind of America first kinds of moments, but you could also look to, the Civil War, the 1840s and 1850s, and the ideologies that are also at play in those moments are really salient. So dare I, introduce another one, but from the book, and one of the things you see, a little bit sub rosa in my chapter, are arguments about civilization. that very often this is about civilization, the way American policymakers and citizens and others think about their place in this as a kind of Anglo-Saxon or Western civilization, and then about the relationship between civilizations, not in some necessarily Huntingtonian sort of clash of civilizations way, but sometimes in that perspective, right? And this can have a racial hierarchical component, it can have an economic component or a technological. So those dimensions of ideologies related to civilization were a surprising finding in the book, and they have a kind of fit with these moments of debate, like 1992, right? Coming out of that, what's the new world order going to look like? And should it be, you know, more the vision of a Perot or a Buchanan of a U.S. minding its own business and thriving on its own terms? Or is it a U.S.-led world where the U.S. is spending precious resources to help others and thereby, supposedly, they would question, help themselves?
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit more about this idea of the ideologies of civilization, because, you know, that was in my own research when about Henry Stimson and the War Department during World War II, you know, in the 1930s, in between the time when he's Secretary of State and then he comes back as Secretary of War as France is collapsing after the Nazis invade in the spring of 1940, one of the underpinnings of a lot of his foreign policy rhetoric, indeed, I think over his long foreign policy career, was this idea of Western civilization and this idea of like the progress of Western civilization. But the way that he sort of interpreted the fascist and right-wing militarist threat emanating from Germany, Italy, and Japan was that they were posing sort of this internal, unprecedented threat to the Western civilization. It wasn't like an external threat, but it was coming from within, and that was even more something that had to be defeated, because once it becomes visible, it's already too late. Like the ship has sailed, and it becomes that much more difficult to root it out and destroy it. And of course, you know, he winds up being quite prophetic, even though no one is really listening to him in the 30s, because then, you know, the Nazis and the Japanese become so powerful, you know, by the early 1940s and Italy to a lesser extent, that, you know, it takes some massive world war to defeat these totalitarian powers. So I was wondering if we could talk about so the through lines of this idea of civilization as an ideology in U.S. foreign policy. I mean, that's something that you said was one of the surprising findings of the book.
Yeah, we didn't expect to hear it in so many chapters and see it in so many sort of historical moments. And I think you're pointing out a great way to understand sort of threats from within and threats from without. You know, there's a terrific chapter, I think it's the second one in the book, by Benjamin Coates, on American presidents and the ideology of civilization. That's the one that confronts this most directly. But you see this in a number of other contexts throughout the book. You know, one of the things that Coates does is talk about civilization as kind of a capacious container for empire as well. And so how presidents have used ideology of civilization to advance their varied visions of empire, from sort of Jefferson's you know, Republican empire of democracy, to more, you know, more overt, direct kinds of civilizational projects to advance empire through territorial acquisition. Not that wasn't Jeffersonian as well. But, you know, I think one of the things that we see in the civilizational arguments in ideological terms in foreign relations are claims about racial hierarchies, claims about who and what counts as an American, which is something we've hit on before. So immigration is deeply implicated there. It also suggests different kinds of visions of singular versus plural. Are there multiple civilizations at work in the US and around the world? And how the U.S. might be rooted in antiquity. So if you think about the founding moments of, you know, basing American democracy on ideas about, you know, ancient Rome and Greece and early democracies, but updating that through kind of Enlightenment principles, which civilization or civilizations does the U.S. belong to, is part of that contest over questions of civilization. You know, I think one other element that we find in pushing this through the whole sway of U.S. history, it helps to locate that analysis sort of within modernity. So once you get to more modern periods and you look at civilization and political rhetoric, that's where you really see it operationalized. And that's kind of what Coates suggests. And that's maybe your example there too. After World War One, you know, presidents talk a lot more about defending civilization, and they're not as invested in promoting it, right? So they're, you know, it's not this project of civilizing; it's about a defense of civilization. And frankly, back around again, and you know, I didn't expect that we'd do this, but if you think about the more recent presidencies, and particularly the Trump administration, his version of civilization, a very narrow one, very Western, you know, very Anglo-Saxon, if you will, was not about promoting, but it was very much about defense, right? It was very reactive, under threat kind of thing. Whereas if you think about the earlier 18th, 19th century version, it's about advancing a kind of maybe even multiple civilizations approach to this. And that seemed to be a divide that I hadn't thought much about in this speculative chapter, and some of the other chapters, you know, flesh out a bit.
Yeah, no, that is really interesting thinking about the different ways that the idea of civilization is deployed, depending on the context in which they're being talked about, which seems like an obvious point, but it really plays out in really different ways. So, you know, in times of crisis, the idea of defending civilization, sort of the U.S. being in this position to, you know, take up that mantle, which is, I think, very much the way that Simpson had thought about it versus, you know, other times where, you know, things are maybe less turbulent and sort of this idea of promoting Western civilization, you know, as a form of ideology in which this is, you know, sort of a bastion of progress and forward movement, as opposed to, you know, other ideas of civilization, which, you know, various people within the United States thought is backwards or perhaps not as, you know, producing as many positive outcomes. I mean, you know, not to talk about Simpson so much, but, you know, in the earlier part of his career, especially he was right as the sort of debate over empire was taking place in the United States after the Spanish-American War, you know, he was talking, you know, quite privately because he was not a well-known person at the time, but it was really illuminating of his later, you know, ideas about racial hierarchy, especially around the context of African-American serving in the military or Japanese-American internment, that, you know, he was against absorbing the Philippines into you know, the American polity, because he thought Filipinos were, you know, not incapable of self-government and that, you know, we shouldn't be infecting the body politic was the way that he talked about it, which was really fascinating given the fact that later in his career, he becomes the American governor of the Philippines.
Yes,
and
right.
Then, right.
I was going to say, I was thinking
right.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And then it's like working with Filipinos on exactly this idea of like trying to give the colonial elites more authority over Filipino internal affairs and sort of putting them in a position in which they could basically, you know, gain their independence, right? It was sort of this, the Philippines was basically, right, a War Department run protectorate or possession, and we're going to put them on the road to self-government, but they need the white people to sort of teach them how to do it. And this was very much how he and other many, many other Americans thought about it at the time. And so, you know, that's like really fascinating, this idea of civilization playing out in a very different way there.
Yeah, and just to connect that, you know, to our previous points about unilateralism and multilateralism and the timing of that shift where people have begun to think that the U.S.'s default setting was more multilateral, right, the as kind of ideas about Western civilization, you know, advance in political rhetoric in the U.S., how policymakers think, but also then how citizens, regular citizens think, and we see this in one of the chapters in particular, you know, they come to sort of like justify multilateral transatlantic commitments and connections, right? So you get a kind of, well, if we're part of Western civilization, then it makes sense that the U.S. should be in a binding collective security agreement, NATO, right? 1949. And then you see this moving, and Coates talks a little bit about this, about, you know, American policymakers deploying this language. It's a little bit very Simpson-esque, actually, you know, deploying this, you know, saying like the birth of Western civilization was on the banks of the Tiber or in Greece or Iran is the fountain of Western civilization. Or, you know, Reagan says Egypt's a nation which cradled Western civilization in its arms. And people said similar things of Japan and Korea. And suddenly you've got, you know, Western civilization and civilized nations, you know, being the necessary, you know, prerequisite for all multilateral commitments. Hey, you're a civilized nation, and defined as such, we're part of the we of the world. But what's the flip side of that? Decolonization, you know, is discrediting civilization, right? It's saying that these kinds of hierarchies and this kinds of oppression and suppression are endemic in this kind of vision of civilizational progress. And so you also see this pushback against some of this civilizational language. And so then what we don't see, what Coates notes and a couple of the other chapters notes as you move through the 20th century, you see a lot less of civilizing missions. And you might see civilizational terms for a variety of things, but you don't see it in terms of Soviet threats in particular. But you do see it, and this is again connects us to our previous part of the conversation, you do see it internally. You do see Americans thinking about their relationship to the world and a kind of crisis of American civilization. You know, are we, particularly conservatives, appropriately moral, appropriately, in favor of free enterprise? I'm thinking of the Hoover's arguments about liberty, against the New Deal, and then all the way up through the U.S. should be like Gibraltar and not be part of the Marshall Plan and not be in the Korean War. You know, so you see this kind of crisis of American civilization writ small, just this nation. Virtually the same moment that you're seeing this expansion of ideas about Western civilization that eventually encompass even to some extent Japan and Korea in these big multilateral Cold War kinds of commitments. So it's really fascinating to see this in there. And, you know, if you're not looking at attentive to one language and two ideas and ideologies, you're not going to quite find this in the sort of through line of U.S. foreign policy. You can find the policy debates, you can find some of these other elements, but focusing centrally on the lens of ideology really gives you some new vistas on U.S. foreign relations, I would argue.
Yeah, no, definitely. Switching gears again, just to close out our conversation, you and David start your introductory chapter, thinking about Barack Obama and sort of his ideology of almost anti-ideology, which I think it's very much an ideology in and of itself, especially in his approach to foreign policy. And I was wondering if you could sort of unpack that for our listeners a little bit and talk about the dangers of, basically trying to sideline the idea of ideology in the creation of American foreign policy. Because I do think that this does trip up President Obama personally and the Obama administration as they confront a lot of the problems that they were looking at during his presidency.
So one, I absolutely agree with you. I think you're right. And I was surprised as we wrote this, as we conceived this, we gathered all in Oregon in 2019 for a big international conference of many of the authors. Unfortunately, not everybody could be there, but many of them. We hashed this out. We debated to some extent then, what were the ideological blinders of the Obama administration? And then as David and I were writing this and rewriting it, it became more and more clear to us that we had to kind of call that out. So the argument you heard as Obama ran for the presidency in 2008 and operationalized his National Security Council kind of philosophy was quote unquote pragmatism over ideology. Now of course I would argue that pragmatism as a political philosophy is ideological or functions ideologically. So there's that, right? The William James's terms, what's the cash value of an idea? Constantly provisional, always being updated. It's an intellectual tool. But that did sound refreshing, right? So one of the things he said, to put it crassly, don't do stupid shit, right? So his argument was that a kind of ideological commitment to nation building, a kind of grandiose Wilsonianism, had led to the very mistaken moves of the Bush administration after 9/11, to the forever wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And obviously those were not popular, and he had voted against them, which is part of why he, was able to move forward against Hillary Clinton, and then win. But taking a step back and thinking about the political philosophies that involved there, right? What his administration publicly argued in terms of those deeper commitments was that material drivers were most important, and that having a kind of grand strategy or set of national security strategies that were founded on specific core commitments that could be encapsulated in a concept or set of concepts behind, don't do this, don't do that, or do this, was wrong, was mistaken, was the kind of thing that led nation states and particularly the U.S. in various moments awry. Right. So he would point to things like containment, in fact, that the containment had spun out such that you wind up in the Vietnam War. So let's not have that was what they said. Now, the problem with this non-ideological ideology was that it did privilege ideological factors, but it led them to say to make the case that they weren't doing it. And so when you look at one of the best examples here, and we were able to get it in just under the wire as we put the book to press, is Ukraine, is Russia. Right. So one of the things that we heard so much as the Obama administration, quote unquote, pivoted to Asia was that, Russia was a waning power. Their economic power was, premised on fossil fuels, which couldn't last forever and were subject to wild, changes in value over time. And their capacity for nuclear weapons with a slowly hollowing out military, and so he thought that China was a much more important power in the world stage. And in fact, you can find all kinds of quotes from Obama himself and members of the administration, really pretty much dismissing Russia. And then they're blindsided in 2014 when the Crimea is annexed, and they're blindsided by the interventions of Russian special ops, particularly intelligence operations, messing with European elections, 2016, getting involved in the U.S. one, right? They didn't know even how to talk about that. And so the argument that David and I really make, and we're not trying to hammer the Obama administration, but just to note this, they're ideological orientation to reject ideology fundamentally underscored their need for a guiding ideology, that they dismissed too many factors with their own preconceptions, and that really harmed policy planning in particular related to Russia, but also more broadly didn't allow the Obama administration to develop something like a grand strategy or something bigger, right? And so, there were all these arguments. Does Obama have a demi doctrine? Is there a doctrine at all? Think about, the arguments about Syria and a red line and not pursuing that. It looked very ad hoc. It looked like more like the caricatures of the JFK administration, like crisis management, And I think, when we look in historical perspective, we'll see, what it looks like. But certainly as we were putting this book to press and thinking about the ideologies that had guided recent administrations, eschewing ideology really doesn't play well. And in particular, because we have ideologies at work, and so we might as well interrogate them and put all those presuppositions on the table and not pretend that they're not there. And another element of that I think is important is that this then infected and inflected the dismissive way that the administration talked about the so-called blob, right, the foreign policy establishment. And it isn't to say that there aren't many problems of foreign policy groupthink in the U.S. You and I could probably spend a whole nother session just talking about those problems. But that said, dismissing those folks who have area expertise, and it's not like they dismissed them out of hand entirely, but that kind of thinking goes hand in hand with a kind of dismissive attitude towards more broadly the roads of ideology in shaping the path forward for foreign policy.
Yeah. Now, when you were talking about all the quotes that Obama or his team were making during his presidency about dismissing Russia, it just made me think of perhaps the most well-known one, which is the third presidential debate between him and Mitt Romney in the 2012 election, in which he's basically like tormenting Romney for calling Russia like America's biggest geopolitical foe. And a couple of years later, especially with all of the things that are happening in Ukraine, after the 2014 illegal annexation of Crimea, Romney's looking, kind of like prophetic, in a way that, made Obama, I think, look kind of silly, even though I don't think Romney had any like specific, expert geopolitical insight. But it definitely was not a good look for the Obama administration only a couple of years after, Obama was, making fun of Romney for that. But
absolutely. And it fits with other permutations of that, the Assad regime in Syria, underestimating their capacity to deal with, the civil war and insurgency, and then being backed by Russia, that didn't seem to mean as much to the Obama administration as it probably ought to have. And there's a number of other factors like this that I think, have profound ideological dimensions, and yet they were trying very actively to suggest that they weren't that, right? That they were being driven by material drivers. This is almost a Marxist orientation. This is certainly a new left, right? Economic drivers are most important in the world, and ideas and ideologies don't matter as much, and they're harder to track, and therefore, arguably less important. But if you think about what we've heard Putin say in recent, you know, months about his sort of vision for a grand Rus, you know, imperial Rus, you know, that goes back to some not even actually historically grounded era, it's very much this sort of ideological orientation to something that's, you know, pie in the sky, and willing to sacrifice all kinds of things, you know, that seem fundamentally irrational, right? But these are the sorts of things that when you look at other ideologies as they've operated in foreign relations, for instance, you know, mission ideology, saving the world in one generation, those kinds of grand world shaping orientations are the things you need to take most seriously, I would argue.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that really brings us full circle to where we started the conversation, talking about, you know, ideological versus material drivers, and how you should ignore ideological underpinnings at your own peril. So thank you so much, Chris, for coming on. I thought this was a wonderful conversation. The book is Ideology in U.S. Foreign Relations, New Histories. It was just released August 2022 with Columbia University Press, co-edited by Chris Nichols, who I was just speaking with, and David Milne. So thanks very much, Chris, for coming on. And to our listeners, thank you very much for listening. And we'll see you again soon.
All right. Great. Thanks so much for having me on.